Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Udi.
Hello, Joan. Good morning.
Well, it's great to have Udi back again to give us further enlightenment about the history of the Jewish people. And today, Udi, we're talking about...
So today we're talking about the Jewish Enlightenment, how it began, how it progressed, and where it is today.
Okay. Go ahead.
So... Joan, when do you think Jewish Enlightenment began?
You told me it came with Napoleon.
So you already know the answer. That's cheating. So exactly, Napoleon, not only for the Jews, but for all of Europe, is exporting the French Revolution. Napoleon is conquering mass areas in Europe and beyond Europe even. And Napoleon brings a message of freedom, equality, women rights, patriotism, all sorts of blasphemous ideas that nobody really likes where he gets to. That is the leadership of the local religion, whether it is Christian, Jewish, or any other religion. However, Napoleon brings another thing to the Jews, and that is emancipation. Wherever Napoleon reached, the Jews receive, not to a full extent, not in 1 second, and definitely not to what we know today, but they do receive equal rights as equal citizens, or not citizens, but residents of a certain country. And that is all political changes that change the reality of the Jewish people and enable them to start think beyond. There's a very famous story about two rabbis in a city in Eastern Europe while Napoleon's army is marching into the city. One rabbi is saying, we need to pray that Napoleon will lose the war, because he wants the old regime, the one that is against the Jews, supposedly, the one that forced them to remain in the shtetl, will prevail. And that's how the rabbis will still have their authority. The other rabbi says, we need to pray for Napoleon to win, because he will give us equal rights. This is the bells of the Mashiach, no less. Napoleon, by the way, for those who don't know, was suspected of bringing the Messiah in Judaism and also in other religion, by the way. Both of them, of course, are going out with this message, and the Jews, I would say...
Perplexed.
That's a very good way to put it. Some of them are in favor, some of them are against, and some of them, well, we'll wait, and then we'll decide after. After Napoleon will lose or win, then we'll decide who are we praying for, Napoleon or not, right? First we'll see who wins the match, then we'll make the bet. And so that's what's happening in many areas in Europe.
And that was across Europe.
Well, this story is specifically about a certain town, I don't remember the name now, in Eastern Europe, but definitely that was the situation in most areas in Europe where Napoleon got to, or where Napoleon's message got to, because Napoleon's army doesn't have to reach somewhere in order for his message to exist over there. At any case, the emancipation that Napoleon is bringing with him is opening a gate. And that is a gate to be enlightened. That is a gate to see what is happening in the other areas of the Jewish community, of the non-Jewish community, and even in the countries next to you, to learn, to study, and to continue with that. And that was an option that was closed to most Ashkenazi Jews throughout the second half of the Middle Ages. So Sephardic Jews have a very different story. They were enlightened from the beginning. They didn't need Napoleon to come and tell them about science, because they were scientists themselves, all the rabbis. So it's a very different story.
And they didn't cross culture at all, the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic.
They did cross culture, but not to the extent we know today. Not a global village. They did cross culture. For example, the halakha that a man can only have one wife. It's something that started in Ashkenaz and continued to the Sephardic areas, to North Africa and Israel and Asia. For example, many halachot from North Africa and Asia came to Europe, so there's influences, definitely, but not to the extent we know today. Not, they didn't live in this, they didn't share a community. There were two communities with the same religion. In any case, Ashkenazi Jews in the first half of the Middle Ages were also quite open to changes. The Judaism changed, the government, either the kings, the prince, the duke, the bishop, whoever was in charge of a certain town in Europe, gave them a privilege to reside in that town with a permission to work in civil occupations. And the Jews did that. As once you work with a non-Jew, once you have privileges, you also read, you also change, your religion change. And that's something that happened all throughout the Middle Ages. Towards the end of the Middle Ages, however, because of trends in the Christian world, regardless to the Jews, we have much less influence. If we're generalizing, of course, the Italian community is very different, and so is South France is very different, but in general, that's what happened. And the Jewish community, I wouldn't say is stopping, but maybe is pausing. And the changes that are happening much slower. The rabbis that are seeing Napoleon and are seeing the changes that are happening in Europe, exactly as their priests' counterparts, are fighting against it because they're losing their authority. Not necessarily a religious theological question, but just politics, tax. Who gets the taxes? Is it the Jewish community or is it the government? Because if it's the government, then that means the Jewish community is losing income that it had for hundreds of years. So it's not a matter of theology, it's a matter of politics.
So didn't they pay taxes? They pay taxes within their own community.
So a lot of times, again, I'm generalizing here, we don't have time to go into specifics, but many times the Jewish community took the taxes from all the members and moved it as a group to the local nobleman or bishop. That's not the case in a modern country when you pay as an individual and not as a community. And that's a big problem. So you would have rabbis that today we will call them liberals or ultra-Orthodox, and they are all against the changes because they want the money. And you'll have others that don't care about the politics and they look beyond it from both spectrum of the religion that are very pro-change. So it's not a matter of streams in Judaism yet. It's rather a matter of how I cope with emancipation, with modernization, with the changes that the Western world is bringing to the Jewish communities. The average Jew, by the way, had no idea there's a change. Because when you pay taxes, you don't really care who do you pay them to. If you pay them eventually, that's what something you don't like. So the local Jewish community, the average Jew didn't really knew about the changes. Those who knew about the changes were the two edges. The top part of the Jewish community, intellectuals, wealthy people, pious people religiously, they were in contact all of a sudden more than before with Christians and to some extent with different sects of Christians. At the same time, at the lower bottom, the lower edge of the Jewish community, the criminals, the prostitutes, the beggars, they are also more in contact with their Christian counterparts than before. Because those two groups in Jewish society were the groups that look outwardly and adopt the changes faster than anybody else. However, the 90% that in the middle, those who are not really poor or criminals or not really wealthy or intellectuals, they had no idea there is a change. They only read about it in the paper, right? So that's the beginning of Jewish Enlightenment, something that's very political, completely not pious, theological, intellectual values. All of that will come. But it is not the beginning. The beginning is with Napoleon's army, the revolution that gave prosperity, that gave equal rights, that gave that opened the door for the Jewish community. And it is a very complicated revolution to understand. Even today, there's a Chinese I don't remember his name, a member of the Communist Party. Where was I? One of the officials a few decades ago. And somebody asked him, what does he think about the French Revolution? And he says, well, it's only 300 years after. It's very too early to say. which is funny, but it's actually quite true. 300 years is nothing, as we know, in Jewish history of 4,000 years. And in globe, and the same thing in Chinese history of 4,000 years. So it's, we're very similar to that extent. At any case, after the political change, we have people, mostly rabbis, but not only, that are now using their privilege to reside in a certain town in order to study with all sorts of study groups in Europe.
So the opportunity to go further study was taken up firstly by the religious people.
They are the only people who exist. Everybody is religious when, in the time we're talking about.
Yeah, but secular, the leaders.
But definitely the leaders. Again, if you're not a leader, if you walk 15 hours a day in a factory or in the field, when you come back home, you couldn't care less about emancipation. You just want to sleep, have your dinner, have breakfast, and go back to work. Because that's what you do. If you're a rabbi, if you're intellectual, if you're a teacher, which were the elite, by the way, in the Jewish community, then you can do those things. Still, vast majority are not doing this, of course. Vast majority are living their lives. But a proportion of the Jewish, of those leaders, religious leaders of the Jewish community, are going out and just studying with Christian priests, studying with philosophers, studying in universities. They are studying, and their studies are influencing their Jewish preaching.
So the new ideas are being spread.
New ideas. Now, rabbis always studied non-Jewish texts throughout the ages, from antiquities through the Middle Ages until modernity. Rabbis in all sects and streams always studied not Jewish religious texts, philosophical texts, and ethical texts that are not Jewish. And it influenced them since ever. It's not something new. The difference, and the big difference, is that they always either tried to get authority from a higher rabbi to agree with them, to agree with what they're going to publish, or they did it in their own community, something very local. Okay, that's why we have different minhagim. So the Dutch Jews, they observed 1 hour between milk and meat. That's the halakha until today. I'm in my father is from the Netherlands originally, so I observe. I'm a vegetarian, but my brothers and sister observe 1 hour between. If you're from other parts of Europe, you observe 4 hours. If you're from parts of Asia, you observe 6 hours, and so on. So, and all are true. And all halachically okay in terms of halacha. Because the halacha changed based on the local traditions. So either they've tried to create changes, which they had, in their local community, or they have done it with a superior rabbi, somebody is higher than them in authority and wisdom. What's happening now, because they are individuals, now they can write a book and publish it all across Europe without any authority. Now again, they can a rabbi in France can influence a person in Hungary. A rabbi in Romania can influence a person in Germany.
All writing in Hebrew.
Of course. Almost all writing in Hebrew. We have a proportion of the books that are written in Yiddish, but that's a small proportion. The majority are writing in Hebrew, definitely. And those people are influencing each other. Speaking of language, Joan, some rabbis are writing in the language of the country they reside at. English, French, German, Hungarian, or Dutch, all sorts of languages. Something that was not existing in Ashkenazi tradition, right? Again, Sephardic, they were born enlightened. Okay, Maimonides is writing in Arabic centuries before Ashkenazic are even thinking about concepts of that. So that's a very different story. However, inside Ashkenazi community, that's a huge revolution. People are also writing in Hebrew, and they're conversing with the non-Jewish counterpart, and they see that there's a grammar for a language. and that their Hebrew is not grammatically correct. Because for hundreds of years, Hebrew was only used as a written language, not as a spoken language. So there was nothing grammatic about it. So now we have people starting to write Hebrew grammar as a topic, which is a huge revolution. Because now they're starting to look at Hebrew as a language and not as a sacred object. Now, if we look on what progressed from that, then we see slowly, and of course we're jumping decades and decades in this conversation in 30 minutes, but slowly we see newspapers in Hebrew of enlightened people, starting with rabbis, but very soon, in a matter of 5, 10, 15, 25 years, we see people that are not rabbis writing in Hebrew essays about all sorts of things. We see a guy called Leopold Zuntz, one of the most important people in Jewish Enlightenment. And he's writing an essay that became the starting text of every Jewish science that exists since then. It could be studying the Torah, it could be studying the Talmud, it could be archaeology, it could be theater, it could be grammar, it could be Jewish history, it could be...
What is it?
Anything. And he writes and he details a list of things that if we really want to understand Judaism, we will need to understand those. And then he make a list. Things we don't know.
Checklist.
We are still working to cover his checklist. Okay, that was about 200 years ago. And we are still working on that. But all the revolutions that occurred in all Jewish streams are basing themselves on a reaction to this pivotal text. A text that's creating ripples all across Europe. Later, after a decade also in the Sephardic communities. Not a decade, a century, I'm sorry. And definitely across the ocean in the New World that is going to be a big community in 150 years from the time he's writing the text. At any case, Jewish science is produced. So people are studying the Torah in scientific tools. And then they start saying, well, maybe, just maybe, parts of the Torah were not written by God. Maybe parts of the Mishnah are rules that were added throughout the Middle Ages. Maybe Jewish history is not as we thought it was. Maybe it's completely different. And we just blocked out a lot of events. Maybe geologically, we are coming from a different area. Maybe our language is different. Maybe.
So it's questioning.
Because one of the most important things in science is to question. When people question, they give answers. And when those answers are given by doctors and professors and intellectuals and authors and public speakers and preachers, but not rabbis, then now the rabbis needs to react. Okay. So some rabbis go to the university. They also study. They're a part of this phenomena. Some of the rabbis, even though not studying in university, are thrilled. They see it as a sign of the Mashiach. Because everybody are now asking the questions, not just the rabbis. Everybody is studying. The text is accessible to everybody now. So that's definitely something that is messianic. Okay, everybody is going to know everything. If everybody will know everything, then we can all, you know, that's the Mashiach's times. Other rabbis are freaking out. Pardon my French. Okay, they don't know what to do. Because suddenly, a congregant can ask them a question that they don't know the answer to. Or, worse than that, tell them they're wrong. Or even worse than that, go to the government, the non-Jewish government, and say that the rabbi is wrong. And we have trials in Europe against rabbis by congregants suing the rabbi for boycotting or for excommunicating or for ruling a halakha that is not aligned with the community needs, the state law, women rights, or the Jewish philosophy. The governments again, some governments are conservative. They will rule in favor of the rabbi. Some governments or judges are very liberal, so they'll rule with the congregant. But it's not...
And these are outside judges, not judges within the community.
Definitely. Outside judges, people, non-Jewish, a Christian judge. Definitely. So that changes the authority of the rabbi. Rabbis need to react, and they have to react fast, because soon they won't have any community to worry about. One of the leaders of this reaction is Achatam Sofer. Achatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, is a rabbi in Hungary. And he rules that anything new is forbidden from the Torah. Hachadash asur min haTorah. Now, it is a phrase in Talmudic sources, in Mishnaic sources. We have a phrase, the new is forbidden from the Torah, but the new in context is talking about the new wheat and new other types of crops that you grow, and they are new. So let's say you have a field, you gave 10%, now you have new parts of it, what do you do? Or all sorts of different aspects of aser and all sorts of different donations you need to give from a new field, not necessarily relating to that 10%. But in any case, something that has, it's not about new in general. It's a very specific agriculture term. He takes that term, and after understanding he has to react to the reality, he's saying anything that's new is forbidden. Not relating to agriculture. Anything. Language is forbidden. Changing your clothing is forbidden. Changing your diet is forbidden. Changing your anything that is has to do with something in your lifestyle is forbidden. That is the beginning of ultra-Orthodoxy. Okay? That is the beginning of ultra-Orthodoxy.
With a rationale that is still...
with a rationale that is still there, but it's definitely very changing rapidly. Because it's very different not to access anything new in a reality where everything is changing every second.
When you have a new baby, is a new.
Yeah. anything. A few decades before Rabbi Moshe Sofer, we have communities that decide to rule, to have changes in the community, to change the seating arrangements, to allow other Jews to eat kitniot on Pesach, to eat all sorts of things that Sephardi eat and Ashkenazi Kadon eat, like hummus and rice and all sorts of things. There are communities that decide to move the Bima, to move the Torah servers, to even alter a few of the blessings. All changes that throughout history happened all the time. But they happened slowly. They happened in a matter of centuries. And they happened locally. And now those changes are fast and are spreading.
And without the internet even.
Without internet. So most rabbis are agreeing with it. Even if they disagree with the change, they remain within the context of the community and they argue against the changes that were done from inside the community. Okay, that's one group. Another group are happy with the changes because they are leading the changes. The third group is leaving the communities. They are leaving the traditional Jewish community, many times illegally, because the state law still demand all every Jew to be a part of a Jewish community where they live. So they leave the Jewish community and establish new communities. That split, that's the beginning of Orthodoxy. Okay? Mm-hmm. Those who remain in the traditional communities, that is the progressive, liberal, reform, depends how you see it today. So if we look on the history, there was a community, a traditional community, that changed into something that is more progressive or liberal, but still enabling those who are Orthodox to remain a part of the community. Okay, so imagine a synagogue with one minion which is Orthodox and another minion which is progressive, one rabbi and a board, and they all live happily ever after. So that will be one type of the Judaism. Another type are those who leave the Judaism, leave the Jewish community and establish a new stream. That's the Orthodox. Very, very, in other areas in Europe, the opposite happens. the communities are Orthodox. The majority is one something Orthodox. Mm-hmm. And those who leave the community and set up a new stream and leave traditional Judaism are the progressive. Mm-hmm. So again, depends on which part of Europe someone is leaving and someone is staying.
Okay? It depends where the majority is.
Exactly.
Right?
It depends. The majority and also on the government. Because even if the majority are pro-change, but the government, as we have in many areas in Germany and in Belgium or in Scandinavia, the government doesn't want the Jews to change. It's fighting them. Mm. So they forbid the Jewish community to change. Then that will also influence who is leaving the community. Mm. Okay? So we can definitely know that in the beginning, those who left are the Orthodox. In Orthodox historiography, you read about the fact that they left in order to save Judaism. Of course, in liberal historiography, you would read that they left, and by leaving, they have left Judaism. Mm. Okay? So, of course, depends who writes history. Neither of the sides is correct. Mm. Both remain within the realms of Judaism because Judaism have changed once Napoleon enabled it to be changed, once Napoleon has brought change into the life of the Jews in a very slow process. Now, another thing that's happening very fast after Enlightenment is that some Jews are saying, we actually don't care about religion. It's not that they're becoming secular, because that term doesn't exist yet, but they are definitely emphasizing something else. And they're emphasizing the peoplehood, the nation. Okay? And
the culture.
Not the culture, but more the belonging to a Heimische, to a family, to a clan. And that is the beginning of national Judaism. And that's the beginning that will be from it evolve modern Zionism. Mm. Okay? Something that was a part of Judaism. All of those things changes. And conservatism and orthodoxy and splitting and not splitting and economic and blah, blah, blah. All of those were traditionally a part of Judaism. But now, after the Enlightenment, after emancipation, the Jews can choose whatever they want to do.
So the progression is that the changes are still happening, but still at a snail's pace.
It's a good question. You can say that in the first century after emancipation, the changes were very rapid, and since then we are very slow in changing anything. But I'm not sure that's accurate. I think we just receive different changes in different places in time.
And it depends on the community around us also.
Exactly.
And how we interact with others, whereas I think at one stage we were cut off from the communities around us by having to rely on each other. But the other thing that intrigued me was, so the rabbi was the one that the outside government worked through as the leader of the community.
Yes. At most places. Of course, we're generalizing here a continent in 400 years. So it's not true for everyone everywhere. But in general, there was a definite, they worked with either the Parnas, which was appointed by the community, or with the rabbi.
So the government, the tax collector and so on, would go to the community, to the leader of the community, which was the religious leader.
There was a secular, in quotes, leader, the Parnas. The Parnas was, he wasn't secular, he was religious and he was under the rabbi, but he was dealing with things that are not religious. Money, you know, food, water, sewer system, and so on and so on.
Well, thank you very much, Udi. It's always enlightening to listen to you.
Thank you, Joan.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 9 a.m. And if you've missed the program or want to listen again, you go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom. One word.